Good afternoon. This is session 3266.0, War, Terrorism, and Public Health. Dr. Victor Seidel and I, my name is Barry Levy, will be moderating the session today. And before we formally begin the session, I have a brief announcement from Len Rubenstein, which is as follows. An independent panel of military, ethics, medical, public health, and legal experts today released a report entitled Ethics Abandoned, Medical Professionalism and Detainee Abuse in the War on Terror. This report shows that U.S. military and intelligence agencies directed doctors and psychologists working in the United States military detention centers to violate standard ethical principles and medical standards to avoid infliction of harm. This panel concludes that since 9/11, the Department of Defense and the CIA improperly demanded that U.S. military and intelligence agency health professionals collaborate in intelligence gathering and security practices in a way that inflicted severe harm on detainees in U.S. custody. The report is available, and I'll read this twice, at the website www.imapny.org. That's imapny.org. And you can also try to contact Len Rubenstein, who's at the conference and is at the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins. We have five speakers this afternoon. After each speaker, there'll be a brief period, one or two opportunities to ask questions and hopefully to get answers. The first paper is entitled The Long Journey Home, Family Reunification and the Disappeared Children of El Salvador. The paper will be presented by Liz Barnett, who's a pediatrician at the Robert Wood Johnson Center for Scholars at UCLA, and her co-authors are Eric Stover, Jerry Ryan, and Paul Chung. Liz?
Thank you very much for the honor of presenting to you today and speaking about the disappeared children of El Salvador. I find that I express this best when I tell it like a story, because for me it really has been a story and a journey in my life. So the story started when I was a medical student and I was doing research. Well, it started off actually, I was volunteering with the organization Asociación Pro Búsqueda in El Salvador, which reunites families that were separated by the Civil War. And I spent a summer helping to create a DNA bank of people in El Salvador who were looking for missing relatives. And while I went all around El Salvador getting these buckle-style cheek samples, then bringing them home in a huge duffel bag to San Francisco Airport, luckily nobody questioned me, but I brought them home, they were analyzed, matches were made. But what really stuck out to me was the stories that people told me while we were collecting the samples. And in order to better explain to you what and why I'm here today, I hope that you'll allow me to read you a poem, which is really the best way that I can communicate to you what I've learned from this community. After what the jovenes told me, intimidated, humbled, massively quiet, I carried home in my pocket the sorrowful tears of forgotten mothers and unmarked graves of fallen fathers, of the disappeared children of El Salvador. What the ocean wrote, I distilled beach into sand, diligently, heartfully, transforming tears into theory, testimonies into action, listening to the stories, praying with my ears, intently hearing, reliving memories of cut open throat, of papa's dead live beating heart, of pregnant uteruses slashed and hung on a tree, of desperate mothers muffling, smothering, suffocating their babies to stifle a cry, to prevent a massacre, silence, and gunshots. I soak up the blood of the stories with a permeable palm, absorbing the grotesque and the tainted triumph of survival, reliving the stories so I can share them with you. This presentation is dedicated to the disappeared children of El Salvador. So what I have for you today, I actually have a traditional research presentation, but that was my way of sharing with you a little bit deeper of what this work is about. I'll give you more background on El Salvador's disappeared children, and then I'll share with you our research study objectives and findings. I believe that this work has a global context. Millions of families each year are separated by war, natural disaster, immigration, and other causes, and then undergo family reunification. Yet there's really been little literature on what the process of family reunification is like for people. In El Salvador, there was a civil war, as many of you know, from 1980 to 1992. It was fought between the U.S.-backed Salvadoran military and FMLN guerrilla fighters. During the war, disappearances of children occurred, and they were caused by actions on both sides, and the children were subsequently placed in orphanages and adopted, either locally in El Salvador or internationally. When three mothers living in a refugee camp at the time in El Salvador insisted that their children were still alive, they got together, and then they actually found each of their children living in an orphanage in San Salvador. And this led to the formation of the organization Asociación Pro Búsqueda, which is who I've worked with in this project. In 2005, which is when I did the interviews that I'll be telling you about, there were 765 registered cases of missing children. It's projected that thousands were missing. At that time, 302 were located, and of these, 178 had undergone reunion with their families. Working with Pro Búsqueda, we identified a need to better understand the process of family reunification. So our study objective was to explore the reunification experiences of the disappeared children from El Salvador. To do this, we used a multiple case study design. I collected field notes over many trips to El Salvador from 2005 to 2009. I actually presented findings from the field notes the last time APHA was here in Boston in 2006. And then I also went back and conducted interviews with the disappeared children and their close relatives, 50 interviews. And it's the analysis of the interviews of these young adults who were 24 to 34 at the time that I interviewed that I'm presenting to you today. The interviews probed participants' experiences with separation and reunification. All of the interviews were audio recorded, transcribed into Spanish, and then analyzed for themes about separation and reunification. So the big picture results was we have some factual information on the disappearances. Most children were disappeared from their families during infancy or early childhood. Actually, the youngest age of disappearance was reported at 8 days old. The children tended to be reunited with their families in their adolescence. Some of them were still being reunited in their 20s. Pro Búsqueda today continues looking for missing children. And then we also found that the separation and reunification process was divided into six distinct stages. So the first stage is pre-disappearance. So this is the period preceding the disappearance. And what really stood out is that youth talked about growing up happy, feeling loved by their families, being poor, and they also told me about the mental and physical trauma of the war. Some of the young people, for example, had limbs removed because of shrapnel injuries. The second stage was disappearance. So this is the period when the youth became disappeared from their families. What the youth talked about the physical and mental trauma they experienced. They witnessed atrocities. They told me in detail about their parents being tortured and murdered, themselves being shot, being forcibly taken from their parents' arms, or becoming lost when their community was fleeing what was called a guinda, or a military raid. Then we had the separation period, which describes the period when the child was separated from his or her family. What was really interesting about this period was that we observed a wide range of experiences. Some youth felt very well cared for and loved by their adoptive families or in the orphanages. Others were physically and emotionally abused. We did see, however, a common experience. Everybody seemed to be struggling to develop their sense of identity and struggling for feeling a sense of connectedness or belonging. A lot of these children didn't even have memories of the families that they were no longer with, so they didn't really feel like they fit in anywhere. And what we saw was that in response to family separation, the youth reconstructed family structures. So the head nun of the orphanage, for example, became a mother. Other people in the orphanage were siblings. The next stage is searching. So in this period, the youth were still separated from their families, but they've begun the process of re-meeting their family. So some youth, a minority of them, actually were the ones that initiated the search for their family. Most of them, on the other hand, were contacted by Asociación Pro Búsqueda and told that their family was alive and looking for them. So this stage was essentially characterized by youth either seeking out their family or being willing to be found. And then comes the reunion event. So I had the privilege of attending several reunion events and also talking to many people about what this was like for them. The physical meeting of youth with their families was an intense flood of emotions. The main kind of physical thing you see is lots and lots of hugging and crying. It was pretty much universal at every single reunion I was at. As you might expect, the youth described feeling a huge amount of joy, but they, at the same time, they felt a lot of confusion. Reunions were very painful also because they struggled with feelings of abandonment, with reliving the trauma of the war, and also uncertainty about how they were going to fit in with this new family. So that leads us to our next stage, which is the reunification stage, and this is the period of everything after the reunion. And in response to being reunited, the youth have this kind of ongoing struggle to reshape their identity and their sense of connectedness and belonging to others. We saw that youth's satisfaction with their sense of identity and the quality of relationships that they experienced with their families really varied. Overall, we saw that there were many obstacles to the reunion process, and I'd be glad to tell you more about it later. But most youth recognized reunification as positive. In fact, when we asked them in the interview, they all told me that they were glad that they had reunited with their families. Across all of the stages, three overarching concepts emerged. Identity and connectedness seemed to really be the forces that were moving the youth across the stages. And we also saw resilience very prominently in this community. And resilience describes youth's ability to transcend uncertainty about their sense of identity and feelings of abandonment. And what really stood out about resilience was that one of the motivators for resilience was this themselves becoming new parents and working to fulfill their new family roles. In addition, God and work were strong vehicles of resilience. Despite challenges in their relationship, even if the youth did not have good quality of relationships with their biological families, knowing that their biological families were alive and were somewhere in the world and that they could find them tended to provide a sense of support. So I have some quotes to share with you. One boy said, "I always felt alone. The fact that I found my sisters didn't make my emptiness go away. No. Finding them just served to clear up my doubts and to clarify my true identity." Another quote by a boy who was 5 when he disappeared. "Now I feel happy because before I couldn't count on anyone, but now I know where my family is. Every family has setbacks, and now I know how to find my family if I need help. But I reflect and I decide to stay and fix my own problems." And here's another quote that I think speaks to resilience. "I don't want to say that if I hadn't found my family, I wouldn't have been successful. I'd already moved forward in my life. But there is something that is vital for development, to know your family, to know what a family is and how a family acts. Even if you don't love them very much, our need was so big because of how we had grown up." And the last quote I have for you today was a boy reflecting on his feelings about reunion. He said, "I didn't feel normal. I didn't feel that much happiness the way that my mom did. I'd become used to other things in the orphanage." And to me, this quote illustrates the important point that reunification is incredibly challenging and painful. It really speaks to the preventive aspects of family, of trying to prevent family separation. So our limitations of our study is that there were cultural and language barriers, trust issues, potentially recall bias. Also, the study was focused on youth who were living in El Salvador after their family reunion or raised in El Salvador, so we didn't examine the experiences of youth adopted internationally, and I think that is a valuable area for further research. Pulling this all together, our key findings and interpretations: family separation was traumatic. It has lifelong implications that continues to affect these youth even today, especially on sense of identity and connectedness. We also observed that family reunification was a challenging, ongoing process. It was multifaceted, and despite these challenges, it was overall beneficial for the youth. We also observed that prevention is warranted and that long-term support services are needed. I think it went off, but you guys can probably hear me. Hello? Okay. And finally, lessons learned from these disappeared youth, I believe, extend to children separated from their families in other situations. So what's most striking to me, actually, about this research, it speaks about a very vulnerable and very specific population, and I believe that these the experiences of the youth extend to other children who were separated from their families due to war. But I, from what I've observed, I think that there's a tremendous universality in those experiences, and it also speaks to the experiences of children and families who are separated in other contexts, such as immigration. So, for example, there was a young woman who reunited with her family. She was the only sibling who was disappeared. She was found in an orphanage in El Salvador. She had 17 siblings. After her reunion, all of her siblings except the youngest one emigrated to the United States. And so it created a process whereby her family is now in a new separation with her siblings that are in the United States, and she's essentially one of two children that are in El Salvador undergoing kind of continuous separation and reunification processes with her children. So if I leave you with one kind of take-home message, I just ask you to consider this lens when we think about other issues like immigration and war and how this might affect people's health.
There's time for at least one question. Are there any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Before I introduce the next speaker, let me just call your attention to the fact that in the back of the room there are some newsletters of the Peace Caucus. This is a session sponsored by the Peace Caucus. I encourage you to pick up copies in the back of the room if you haven't already. And I'd like to introduce Bob Gould and Patrice Sutton. Bob and Patrice, would you just please stand up in the back of the room? Thank you for all your work in leading the Peace Caucus, and if you have questions about the work of the Peace Caucus, please be in touch with Bob or Patrice or with Vic or myself at the conclusion of the session. Our next presentation is by Bill Schulz. Bill is the president of the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee based right here in Cambridge. He's a former executive director of Amnesty International USA and has long been involved in human rights-related issues in conflict zones. The topic of his presentation is the dilemma of humanitarian military intervention. Because Bill doesn't have any PowerPoints or other slides, we're just going to leave this up because it enables us to record his presentation. So, Bill, thank you.
Thanks, Barry. I'll try to keep your attention anyway without the slides, though I will acknowledge that it wasn't too long ago that I gave an address at Pepperdine University, and following the speech, a woman came up to me and she said, Dr. Schulz, I couldn't hear a word you said tonight. And thinking to be modest, I said, well, you're probably not missing much. I know, she said, that's what everybody tells me. So I will do my best to make it worth your while nonetheless. In the midst of the 1994 Rwandan genocide, a girls' school was attacked by machete-wielding militiamen in the middle of the night, and the teenagers were rousted from their bed about 2 a.m. and forced to line up in the dining hall, and they were ordered to separate themselves by ethnic group, Tutsi over here and Hutu over there, so that only the Tutsi would die. But not a one of the girls moved. And a second time, the commander ordered them to divide up, Hutu over here, Tutsi over there, and for a second time, not a one of the girls moved. And finally, one of the little girls, naturally terrified, raised her hand and she said, I'm sorry, sir. I'm sorry, sir, but you see, in this school, we cannot separate ourselves because, you see, sir, in this school, we are not Hutu. We are not Tutsi. We are all just little Rwandan girls, at which point every one of the girls was slaughtered. I have always been haunted by the Rwandan genocide because it took place 2 months after I assumed the leadership of Amnesty International, and we were utterly unable to stop it. Especially tormenting to me is how little force would have been required to stop it. General Romeo Dallaire, who was the Canadian general in charge of UN troops in Rwanda when the killing began, General Dallaire asked for 1,500 troops to save the lives of close to a million people. 1,500 to save a million. But the UN, led by the Clinton White House, of course, refused that request, something for which President Clinton subsequently apologized to the Rwandan people. When wickedness is in fashion, as one Rwandan survivor described the genocide, it is sometimes simply impossible to stop it through exclusively nonviolent means. And yet, of course, we also know that military intervention under the guise of humanitarian intentions often reflects mixed motives, often goes awry, often does proportionally more damage than the original sin that it seeks to redress. The Iraq War is, of course, the prime example. The cost of war's projects estimates that up to 180,000 deaths have resulted from that war, including 134,000 civilians, all in the name of preventing the development of non-existent weapons of mass destruction. But other situations have reflected real distress. Slobodan Milosevic did try to ethnically cleanse Kosovo. Omar al-Bashir and his Janjaweed militia did commit genocide in Darfur. Al-Qaeda-affiliated factions did impose Sharia law on northern Mali. Bashar al-Assad has used chemical weapons against his own people in Syria. So how do we decide when military intervention is warranted and when it should be avoided? The bar is appropriately high. Well, in 2005, the United Nations did a remarkable thing. It adopted a resolution that has come to be known as the Responsibility to Protect, or R2P, that challenged the sacred notion of state sovereignty upon which the UN had been founded. Until R2P, a state could do almost anything it wanted to its own residents and invoke sovereign immunity from international intervention as long as the conflict did not spill over its borders. But R2P affirmed that not only a state has a responsibility to protect its residents from genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing, but that if it did not, the international community had a responsibility, not just a right, but a responsibility to intervene, first with diplomacy, then with economic sanctions, and finally with military force if the Security Council authorizes it. That was a revolutionary step for the UN, and it codified several key criteria for when military intervention was justified. It was only justified in the face of horrendous human rights crimes. It was only justified as a last resort, after peaceful, if coercive, efforts had failed, and it was only justified if the Security Council authorized it. So, where does this get us? I suspect most of us would agree with the first two criteria, horrendous crimes and last resort. That would mean, for example, that it would not be legitimate to use military force to stop Iran from developing nuclear weapons, though if Iran were about to use them, of course, a military response might be justified, not on grounds of intervention for humanitarian purposes, but on classical grounds of self-defense. It would mean that if the current process regarding Syria and its inspections fails and there was no other resort to prevent Syria from using chemical weapons again, such intervention would have met the first two criteria. So the first two criteria, those are the easy ones. I suspect we could even add a few more that we would all agree upon. For example, that intervention is only justified if the intervening powers have no self-serving motives, such as the acquisition of additional resources. We can agree that intervention is only justified if military forces have a chance of succeeding and not making the suffering worse. But the real stumbling block comes, of course, with this third R2P criteria, approval by the Security Council. The fundamental issue in all interventions, in other words, is the question of whose authority, by whose authority is it undertaken. It is all very well to be an ethical absolutist and to say that under international law, any intervention not authorized by the Security Council is illegal and hence must be eschewed. But the Council refused to intervene in Rwanda even to the tune of 1,500 troops, and almost 1 million people died as the result. Where is the moral justification in that? It refused to authorize intervention in Kosovo in 1998, which is why the subsequent Independent International Commission on Kosovo called the Kosovo War illegal. But it also said illegal, but legitimate. Legitimate, because it obtained a morally legitimate end. So maybe we don't always need the Security Council. Maybe, as in the case of Kosovo, some other international body, in that case NATO, will do. But in Rwanda, nobody would authorize intervention. Not the UN, not NATO, not the African Union. And so the French finally went into one corner of that country unilaterally and saved tens of thousands of lives. They just did the same thing in Mali, albeit in that case at the invitation of the government. So we're left with a huge quandary. That quandary is particularly acute for us here in the United States, who are only too well aware of this country's historic proclivity for misdirected adventurism, who recognize that the combination of general American disdain for international norms and convictions, coupled with convictions of our cultural superiority, is a lethal one. We know, too, that small countries like Libya and Côte d'Ivoire are often held to standards that the so-called great nations themselves never apply to themselves. But I would point out as well that while the U.S. and the West more broadly has often erred on the side of throwing its military weight around from Vietnam to Grenada, from Nicaragua to Iraq, it has also been the champion of high-minded causes. And in this respect, I commend to you Lynn Olson's new book, Those Angry Days, Roosevelt, Lindbergh, and America's Fight Over World War II, in which we are reminded that it was not just Charles Lindbergh who would have left the world to suffer under domination. It was also initially, at least, such luminaries as Kingman Brewster, the future president of Yale, and even General George Marshall. Well, finally, I want to leave you with a vignette that has influenced my own thinking almost as much as the tragedy of Rwanda. As those of you who have been in refugee camps know, there is a smell in refugee camps, a smell which once you inhale it, you never forget. It is a smell of goat dung and human waste, a smell of sweat and tears and unstaunched menstrual blood, but also a smell of desperation that gives way to sagging shoulders and the decay of the human soul. When I visited the enormous Kolma refugee camp in southern Darfur in 2004, 90,000 teeming people who had been burned out of their villages, their menfolk murdered, many of the women battered and sexually assaulted. I was struck by a thousand things, but what really took my breath away was this. A young woman who, amid the utter squalor and degradation, her clothes, such as they were, tattered and falling off her, wore around her neck a lovely piece of jewelry. Glass, just glass, no doubt, but turquoise-colored glass that constantly sparkled in the relentless sun. At first, I thought it was a religious symbol, and I asked our Arabic-speaking translator to ask her what it was. She says, "It is me," he told me. And at first, I didn't understand. I thought she had simply said, "It is mine," And I asked him again. I asked if he had mistranslated. "What did she say?" I asked. "I don't understand." She said, the translator told me, she said, "It is me." And suddenly I realized, when the women workers who led the strike against the textile mills in Lawrence, Massachusetts in 1912 were being hosed down and beaten by the police, they shouted, "Give us bread and roses." And that chant, "Bread and roses. We demand bread to eat, of course, but we demand our dignity too." That's been a watchword of the labor movement ever since. And here in this dreadful camp was the very same demand. This piece of jewelry this small sparkling piece of glass around my neck. This is me. This is how I know that though I am mere brute flesh, bone, water, swollen tongue, excrement-stained thighs, my most private parts exposed for all of you to see, that though I am brute flesh right now in this horrific camp, I am not just that. I retain a tiny hint of my humanity. I require bread to live, of course, so do the cows and the goats and the sheep. All of us bless them, yes, but I am a human being too. Only human beings wear turquoise glass around their necks, and I am a human being still. And I ask myself constantly, in the face of these dilemmas, who are we sitting in our comfortable homes to tell that woman that the only way that we can give her roses is to get the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Russia, and China to all agree to do so? The world is a complicated place. The issue is a complex one. But at the end of the day, some things are very, very simple.
We have time for a couple of questions. Let me take the prerogative, Bill, and ask you the following question. Under what circumstances do you think the United States or the international community, however that's defined, should intervene in the war in Syria?
I think, Barry, that we should apply the half a dozen criteria that I mentioned here. Obviously, the first issue is whether it is a last resort. Clearly, at the moment, it is far from a last resort. I think that there has to be impending threat of the use of weapons of mass destruction. So an evaluation would have to be made should the inspection process fail. An evaluation would need to be made as to whether, indeed, there is threat of future use of that. And then intervention would have to have a significantly positive chance of resolving the issue without inflicting greater suffering. Now, all of these are very, very difficult judgments to make. I don't pretend that the answer to that is easy, but I do say that if we know that these are the thresholds that have to be reached, and they are high thresholds, but they are not impossible ones, then we come as close as human beings can come to acting in an ethically and socially responsible way.
Are there any other, thank you. Are there any other questions? Yes, right over here, please.
Right.
Repeat the question.
The question is who makes the evaluation and right. Certainly we can say that the U.S. in the vast majority of cases ought not to intervene unilaterally. That's right, that there ought to be some broader imprimatur of some international institution so that the intervention is not a unilateral intervention. And all that I would ask you to consider to complicate the issue is the French unilateral intervention in Rwanda. And had Bill Clinton, at the end of the day, been the only world leader who was willing to intervene as the French did in Rwanda, I just ask whether you would stick to your commitment to the U.S. never intervening by itself. And I think it complicates the issue enormously for all of us.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Bill, for that very insightful and moving presentation.